From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump traveled to Miami, Florida, and gave a major speech on Venezuela on Monday. During his speech, he addressed Venezuelan immigrants living in the U.S., and exhorted the Venezuelan military to switch its support from the current president, Nicolas Maduro, to opposition leader Juan Guaido. He also gave an ominous-sounding ultimatum saying, quote, "We seek a peaceful transition of power, but all options are open." Trump cast his speech more broadly as an attack on socialism. In fact, he used the words socialism, socialist, communism, or communist a total of 36 times in 30 minutes. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida announced that U.S. aid would get through into Venezuela one way or another. Rubio told CNN, "I think ultimately the question is whether it gets through in a way that he's cooperative with or in a way that he's not," referring to Maduro. We go now to Caracas, Venezuela, to speak with Lucas Kerner. He is a political analyst and editor at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Welcome to the program, Lucas.
Great to be here.
So what do you make of Trump's speech? There was a lot in there. He very openly linked the Venezuelan exiles, as he calls them, to the organizing of the aid to get into Venezuela, and very openly asked the Venezuelan military to switch sides. He is not making even the slightest attempt to cloak the fact that the U.S. wants regime change in Venezuela.
Yes, I don't think we saw a lot new there on Monday. I mean, certainly, yes, we saw the usual rhetoric with regard to socialism and communism that is, a very thinly veiled effort to score points, political points against the Democrats in the lead up to 2020. But more importantly, we saw that Trump is, calling on, once again, reiterating calls on the Venezuelan military to oust, through a coup d'etat, the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. And should that fail, threatening military intervention, that all options remain on the table. So evidently, this is throwing red meat to his base, but at the same time, doubling down on Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president of the country, a little-known opposition leader who was little-known before January 5th of this year, and who is, I think we're already nearly a month, we'll be a month into this on Saturday, and is no closer to sitting in Miraflores presidential palace.
So let's actually play a clip from Trump speaking on Monday. I want to bring up specifically what role he thinks Venezuelan exiles are going to be playing. This sounds a bit similar to the sort of Cuba playbook, where the U.S. has for years tried to destabilize Cuba using the Cuban community in the U.S. as a convenient tool. Here is Trump on Monday speaking about Venezuela.
And I want to especially thank the Venezuelan exile community that has done so much to support President Guaido, to organize aid for their compatriots, and to do just a lot back home. Thank you very much for being here.
And that is President Trump on Monday, part of the speech that he gave on Venezuela in Miami. A lot of the Venezuelan immigrants to the U.S. were present. Lucas, how exactly is he using Venezuelan immigrants to the United States? He's basically admitted very clearly that it was this community that helped organize the aid to their compatriots back home. But of course, the aid is a thinly veiled pretext for some sort of U.S. intervention, right?
Yeah, I don't think that the Venezuelan community in the United States is at all involved in this effort. Rather, it is, as we saw on Saturday, it is being carried out completely by the U.S. military and U.S. military jets, which on Saturday landed this so-called humanitarian aid in Cúcuta, just 8 kilometers from the Venezuelan border. And really, we have to understand that the International Red Cross, the United Nations, Oxfam, and numerous other international humanitarian bodies have criticized in no uncertain terms this aid effort as politicized, as an effort to use aid as a instrument for toppling a government which the United States doesn't like, which, you know, of course, is a violation of all of the principles that govern the distribution of humanitarian aid. And moreover, we shouldn't forget that it is Mr. Elliot Abrams who, in the Reagan administration, was key in channeling U.S. weapons, using humanitarian planes earmarked for humanitarian purposes to channel weapons to the Contra paramilitaries in Nicaragua, you know, during the United States' illegal war there. And also, of course, he was supplying weapons to the death squads in El Salvador and Guatemala as well. And he is now resurrected as the U.S. envoy to Venezuela now. So we should be very wary of the U.S. effort to bring this so-called aid into Venezuela in violation of Venezuelan sovereignty. And also remember that Venezuela, that Maduro did ask for and receive humanitarian aid from the United Nations in November and from other international bodies. The issue is not about the aid. It's the issue of who is bringing the aid and with what agenda.
Right. And I'm glad you brought up Elliot Abrams, the U.S. Special Envoy to Venezuela, who in the U.S. Congress seems to have been challenged only by freshman Congresswoman Ilhan Omar last week. He got very defensive when she brought up his role in some of those Latin American countries that you were referring to. Back to the aid. I mean, it's so important to put it into context, right? Because here in the U.S., what we're getting in media coverage is Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro is standing in the way of his desperate, hungry people being able to get aid, that he is purposefully preventing them from having access to aid. And they don't seem to be characterizing how the aid is so politicized. A sovereign, you know, why would a sovereign country accept aid from another nation that's so openly planning on, you know, changing the regime in that country? No country would ever allow aid from such a giver. And so it seems to be a very obvious political stunt intended to basically challenge Maduro, right?
Indeed, and we have to remember that it's also USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is delivering the aid. And USAID has played a very nefarious role in many countries, supporting, in Venezuela, for example, financing the tune of something like $50 to $60 million a year to Venezuelan opposition in its efforts to topple the government through NGO organizations, et cetera, and, you know, in many other countries as well. And obviously, if this were occurring, if a Russian agency were doing the same thing to NGOs in the United States, I mean, it would be a national scandal. But in Venezuela, this is, of course, completely tolerated and normal. And moreover, we should remember that this is $20 million of aid the United States has pledged. Meanwhile, a few weeks ago, John Bolton unveiled the latest escalation of U.S. sanctions in the country, a de facto oil embargo, which is going to cost Venezuela $11 billion in lost oil revenues this year. That's equivalent to $30 million a day. You know, meanwhile, I mean, this is going to have very, very detrimental consequences for the Venezuelan people, the economy, and society. You know, Francisco Rodriguez, who is arguably the foremost expert in the Venezuelan economy and who was an advisor to opposition presidential candidate Henry Falcon, he has predicted that as a result of this oil embargo and also the previous financial sanctions that were implemented in August of 2017, Venezuela's economy is going to contract by over a quarter, by 26% in 2019. And, you know, evidently, the people of Venezuela are going to pay the price for, you know, this economic siege which is being imposed in the country, just like the Iraqi people paid the price in the 1990s when 500,000 children died as a result of the U.S. embargo there. You know, and when Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Secretary of State, was asked about it, if the price was worth it, if so many children died for the United States to topple Saddam, and she replied, yes, the price is worth it. So we must ask the policymakers in Washington, is the price worth it in Venezuela at this time?
And so you're saying that the economic sanctions have against Venezuela imposed by the U.S. have played a much bigger role in destabilizing the Venezuelan economy than we really hear about here in the U.S.?
Indeed. In fact, as a result of this, the financial blockade, which was imposed by Trump basically in August of 2017, when the Treasury Department prohibited U.S. financial entities or financial entities operating in the United States from engaging in lending to the Venezuelan state and its state oil company. And this, you know, basically this denying Venezuela access to the global credit market, preventing it from refinancing its debt, you know, this cost Venezuela an estimated $1 billion in the 12 months subsequent to that. And, you know, Francisco Rodriguez, again, an opposition economist, has, you know, argued that this is was played a pivotal role in the collapse of Venezuela's oil industry. It was a source of over 90% of all its export revenue, and the production fell by over a million barrels a day in that period. So, I mean, this is playing a huge role, you know, just in that period. As a result of those sanctions alone, Venezuela lost around 6% a year in GDP. Just to give you perspective, healthcare spending in Latin America averages around 7% of GDP. So these sanctions, you know, as the U.S.'s own Congressional Research Service said in November in its own study, that these kinds of further economic sanctions will, quote unquote, exacerbate the difficult humanitarian situation in the country. The United States government is fully aware of what it is doing, that is attempting to make conditions in the country so unbearable that the government will fall. And of course, this is illegal under international law, U.S. law, you know, because this is not a national, and it was not a United States, and, you know, a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment of a country.
I want to talk about how the Trump administration is also invoking Cuba. What do you make of the fact that in his speech, Trump referred to Cuba 18 times and linked Venezuela and Cuba? And certainly Cuba has expressed a lot of solidarity. The president, Díaz-Canel has expressed overt solidarity with Venezuela, but it seems as though the U.S. is happy about casting Venezuela and Cuba as part of the same team.
Indeed, Trump and his administration have been very explicit that this is a kind of domino strategy that they're pursuing here, that they want to topple the Maduro government in Caracas, and then they want to proceed to Havana and, you know, finally realize the, you know, 60-plus year policy of U.S. policy of seeking to overthrow the government, the socialist government in Cuba, and then afterwards they want to proceed to topple the Ortega government in Nicaragua. You know, clearly, this is a long-established U.S. regime change policy, and, you know, it's attempting to really overthrow the last of the governments in the region that have stood up to U.S. dictates and have sought to chart a sovereign and independent course, both in their own countries and the region, attempting to build an alternative political, economic integration bodies, for example, the UNASUR, which is the Union of South American Nations, the CELAC, which is the basically all 34 countries in the, all 35 countries in the hemisphere, minus the United States, Canada as a mechanism of integration, the Petrocaribe, the ALBA, all of these bodies, all of these organizations that have really challenged the United States imperial hegemony in the region. And for this very reason, the United States is definitely seeking to topple all of these governments, and Cuba evidently the most emblematic, you know, with the historical legacy of the Cuban Revolution and what it meant for the Cuban people and the people of the hemisphere. And, you know, in Venezuela, of course, there's all this discourse that Cuba is occupying, you know, Venezuela, which is, you know, utterly ridiculous. I mean, given that, you know, the Cuban doctors who, you know, serve in many medical clinics in the poorest parts of Venezuela are, you know, welcomed by the people there and are identified as, you know, part of an international solidarity, you know, mission, as opposed to some kind of occupying force. I mean, evidently, it's a very, you know, callous effort to dissimulate the United States' own, you know, imperial efforts within the country.
Now, Lucas, what about the fact that Maduro is sort of still struggling to hold on to power within Venezuela? What is the sentiment inside Venezuela regarding Maduro? Do you see a strengthening of his base in the face of U.S. threats, that people are sort of realizing that they would rather solve their own internal problems instead of having the U.S. Foisted on them through outside intervention? There are, I understand, pro-Maduro rallies that have been held that we just aren't hearing much about in the U.S.
I think you're definitely seeing a certain closing of ranks within Chavismo, within the Chavista political movement, you know, behind the government, behind Maduro, against this effort to this coup d'etat that the United States is pushing in the country. You know, we have to remember that 6.2 million Venezuelans voted for Nicolas Maduro as president on May 20th, 2018. And you can, you know, that's 31% of Venezuela's total electorate or voting eligible population. You know, compare that, you know, that's pretty much standard, you know, for U.S. presidents. And Donald Trump won with 26% of the U.S. electorate, Obama with 31% in 2008 and a little bit less in 2012. So the idea that Maduro doesn't have, you know, a certain level of popular support or legitimacy is false, despite, you know, certainly, yes, he is deeply unpopular for his inability to resolve the economic crisis. But we should understand that among a large section of Venezuela's population, not just those 6 million people, but many more people who may not support Mr. Maduro, President Maduro, but they definitely oppose the U.S. and its local opposition proxies' efforts to overthrow the government. They reject that and therefore are willing to, you know, back the government against those efforts, to defeat those efforts. Anyway, when you go to many of the popular sectors in Caracas and you see more Chavista paraphernalia than you saw before, I mean, there definitely is a real, I think, instinctual understanding among the Chavista masses, the base, the social basis of this process, that the U.S. and opposition agenda is to topple the government and to literally wipe Chavismo from the political map, seek to, you know, effectively wait. There's a real danger that the opposition seeks to wage a certain kind of dirty war, you know, hunt, you know, of the kind that we saw in Central America under Elliot Abrams in the 1980s or in the Southern Cone in the 1970s, you know, of trying to uproot Chavismo, you know, persecute Chavista activists, political activists, social leaders of all community leaders of all kinds. So there really is an understanding that this is an existential threat that is posed by the United States in this moment.
Has Maduro made mistakes that Chavez avoided?
It's very complex because Maduro inherited the economy as Chavez inherited it, and the country as it was at that time. And, you know, there was a lot of problems, particularly with the issue, for example, the exchange, that we have an overvalued exchange rate that, you know, as a result of the maintenance of a regime of exchange controls, which led to all kinds of distortions in the Venezuelan economy, with things being imported very cheaply, but then, you know, this opened a way for dollars allocated to the state to be resold in the black market, and it has a very, you know, it has created a very toxic kind of logic that Maduro, unfortunately, you know, he inherited, and he has not succeeded or, you know, in overcoming. He has not made the kinds of important economic reforms that, you know, could have perhaps in 2014, maybe even beginning of 2015, led open the way for economic recovery. You know, among those, like, you know, liberating the exchange controls and, you know, implementing a policy of direct subsidies as opposed to indirect subsidies, et cetera. Nonetheless, it's important to recognize that the United States, from the very beginning that Maduro came into office, you know, the U.S. refused to recognize his electoral victory, which is recognized by every other government in the world. The opposition, like, took to the streets. 8 people were killed. The medical clinics, many of them were staffed by Cuban doctors, were firebombed. You know, 2014, the opposition again took to the streets again, trying to oust the president. Who, in that time, you know, they questioned Maduro's legitimacy. Now, at the United States and, you know, the opposition was rejecting his legitimacy then. And then in 2015, the United States declared Venezuela a quote-unquote unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, which even economists Francisco Rodriguez acknowledges that place a de facto kind of financial embargo on Venezuela, because U.S. Transnational corporations, or transnational corporations around the world, and also international financial institutions were hesitant to do business with a country that's been labeled in this way. And, you know, so the jaws began to close around Venezuela beginning in 2015. So, you know, certainly Maduro and the government made a lot of errors that made them vulnerable to the kinds of coercive U.S. measures, but these, you know, sanctions and other, you know, efforts by the United States to weaken Venezuela's economy, both with, you know, Obama's decree that I just mentioned, but also with the subsequent financial sanctions, you know, have, you know, utterly decimated Venezuela's economy. And definitely, you know, right now we can say that the U.S. is the main force in preventing any kind of economic recovery in the country.
Lucas, what do you make of the fact that in an interview last week, Maduro said that his representatives had actually been in secret talks with Elliot Abrams? Do you think Maduro thinks that he might be able to negotiate with the United States on its threatened intervention. What is Maduro's way out, as well as a follow-up?
I think that we have to put ourselves in the shoes of, you know, the Maduro government. You know, they're literally being besieged, you know, by the most powerful, you know, government in the world, you know, that is using all of its economic might just to asphyxiate the economy and is openly threatening military action. So if, you know, if he were not attempting to dialogue or trying to neutralize this menace, I mean, he would be insane. Clearly, he, you know, does not want his country to be bombarded, as was Iraq, as was Afghanistan, as was Libya, et cetera, by the United States, and he wants to lift the sanctions. But, you know, it's very clear from the Trump administration's actions that they're, you know, a recognition of Juan Guaido, this self-proclaimed opposition leader as president of the country, their moves to impose an oil embargo, and likewise their efforts to confiscate Venezuelan assets in the United States, Citgo, which is valued at $7 billion, among, and then obvious other efforts to effectively coerce, in many cases, as was the case in Spain, other countries to join this coalition of the willing, you know, so to speak, in supporting Guaido and attempting to topple Maduro. It's very clear that the U.S. is, you know, as Elliot Abrams also indicated, is unwilling to accept anything but total surrender from Nicolas Maduro, that he must you know, resign his democratically elected office as president of Venezuela and, you know, leave the country and allow the United States to impose, you know, by force a, you know, quite what's being threatened to impose by force a new political and economic order in which, you know, as Jen Bolton indicated, you know, the oil sector will be opened up to U.S. transnational corporations, will be effectively privatized. We have to remember that the blueprint for what we're seeing now was in 2002, when the United States supported a military coup on April 11, 2002, against democratically elected President Hugo Chavez. He was ousted for 47 hours. Elliot Abrams, who was then a Bush administration official, reportedly gave the green light to this coup. The Constitution was suspended by this government, was dissolved, as was the National Assembly, as was the court. Yeah, this is the same constitution that they're now invoking to justify their claim to power right now. Chavistas were, you know, over 50 to 60 people were killed in by the coup security forces, the military, the police, in protest against this undemocratic overthrow of Chavez. Chavistas were hunted down in the barrios. I mean, this was
so all of this could be what's in Venezuela's future if the U.S. is successful. But finally, do you think that the U.S. could go even further this time than it did when Chavez faced the U.S.-backed coup? Because you literally have military aid amassing on the border, or rather, food aid amassing on the border under the guise of military, you know, under the guise of humanitarian intervention. And it's very clear, Trump has made it very clear that all options are on the table, literally. I mean, could the U.S. this time invade Venezuela through Colombia?
I think that we have to, I mean, given the team that is in the White House right now with John Bolton, who, you know, is responsible for the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq, and likewise Elliot Abrams, who was involved in that sordid affair, as well as the dirty wars of the 1980s in Central America, as we mentioned, I wouldn't rule out any option, you know, with regard to the U.S., you know, invading Venezuela. I don't think that it is the first option that they're looking at. I think that right now it's clear that their plan to oust Maduro in the short term failed, and they didn't have a plan B. They thought that the armed forces were going to fissure, and it was going to be, and that's why they keep calling on the armed forces to oust Maduro. They keep trying to bribe whoever they can, but, you know, clearly their promises are not, you know, believable for the armed forces. And so the United States is in a real conundrum. I mean, are they going to engage in some kind of military adventure, which could really have domestic blowback, or are they going to sit back and abandon Guaido and opt for to just asphyxiate Venezuela's economy, and with all the, you know, humanitarian consequences that we can imagine from living in Iraq and other countries? So it's unclear what the Trump administration's next step, but it's very dangerous. And now more than ever, there's really a need for people in the United States to stand up to Trump and stand up to, you know, what this very dangerous precedent that is being set, that, you know, that basically the destruction of a democracy, you know, just because the United States does not like its government. I mean, this is, you know, in order effectively, once again, to steal its natural resources, as John Bolton indicated.
Well, Lucas, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to VenezuelaAnalysis.com from our website. Thanks and good luck.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Lucas Kerner, political analyst and editor at VenezuelaAnalysis.com, joining us from Caracas in Venezuela. We've been discussing the Trump administration's positioning on Venezuela. I'm Sonali Kulhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.